thanks to our sponsor, Ecotricity. Ecotricity is New Zealand's only carbon zero certified electricity retailer. They offset all emissions sourced from wind, hydro and solar. Find out more at ecotricity.co.nz. Hello and welcome to another exciting and slightly more hungover than usual episode of How to Save the World. I'm speaking only for myself, Tim Batts. I'm joined, as always,
with Waveney.
By the beautiful and sober Waveney Worth.
No hangover.
And today we've got a special guest, a friend of mine, a man who I would describe, hopefully correctly, as a lawyer, and now a Māori academic who's completing his PhD in a topic that we will delve into in more depth, but it's in the environmental space. Rānira, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Kia ora, he wā. Tēnā koe moto mihi mai kia. Tēnā koe Waveney. Kia ora. Kia ora. Nice to meet you.
Great to have you here.
Very exciting to talk to you. Rā and I have had some cool, deep chats over a few beers.
Last night.
On multiple occasions about the sorts of things that he thinks about and studies and deals with in his community. So I thought it would be a cool idea to get you on. I'm very like uneducated in this, but I've always been very fascinated by Indigenous methodologies and like relationships to the environment and what we can learn by listening to First Peoples from all around the world.
Me too, actually. And is that what your PhD is focused on?
My PhD is on a lot of things, but yes, that is one of the many elements.
It's always featured. Hard to sum up your PhD.
Don't ask me to do it.
Rānira, would you like to give, do you want to do a little introduction for yourself, if you wouldn't mind, and just tell us what your PhD is? Would that be a good starting point?
Yeah, cool. Kia ora, e hoa. Tēnā koe, mōtō mihi mai kia. Ko te mea tuatahi, ki te mihi au. Kia koe. So I'd just like to acknowledge you as a person, bringing me on the show, having me in your house. Thank you. In Te Ao Māori, we always start with a mihi, so a greeting. So greetings to you, and then say who I am and where I come from. So, ko Rānira te whata tōku ingoa no Tautoro aho. So I'm from Tautoro. It's a little Māori, rural Māori community in Northland. It's about 3 hours away from here. It's my home. It's my tūranga waiwai. Tūranga waiwai means a place to stand, a place to leave, and a place to return to in the future. Tautoro is my tūranga waiwai, and it is a place where my family are. It's a place where I grew up. It's a place that I left, and it's a place I've returned to recently, 2 years ago. Yeah, so it's returning to my tūranga waiwai. That is essentially what the first section of my PhD is about, is the return home, the journey.
Were you gone for quite a while?
Yeah, I left home when I was 17 for university. Moved to Auckland. It's not that far.
No, but same as me. Left home at 17 from uni, Auckland. From a small town in the north. That far north. Welsford.
Yeah. Came to Auckland for university studies. I would always go home, visit home regularly a couple of times a year for whānau gatherings, tangihanga, the funerals. But returned home to live. This is the difference between living and just visiting. And so it was an opportunity to learn more. I never intended to do a PhD. It was just something that propped up one day. Said, do you want to do a PhD? I thought, no, not really. It sounds like more study, to be honest. yeah, it's a great start. But I saw it as an opportunity to learn more. I learned more about myself and saw this opportunity to deep dive into something that I'm interested in. And I'm interested in history. History is something that I'm really interested in. And so I thought, well, what skills that I have to offer? I can write, I can read, I can research. I know aspects of the law. So we went home to Tautoro and started talking amongst my community, finding out what issues were pressing to them. And there are a myriad of issues in Northland, in this Māori community where I come from. One of them was water, the importance of water, importance of ancestral landscapes. So it took a while to figure out what it actually was. And I'm sure a lot of other PhD students have this conundrum. Got this 3 years of study and I have an opportunity to do something great. And what is it going to be about? I had a general idea about what I wanted to do. I guess to start with the title, and that was also a bit of a journey, just to giving it a label. And I didn't want to label it too early because I didn't want it to stifle the evolution of it. But I finally figured out what a title is, and the title of my PhD is Inayane Imua Amuriake, Now, Then, Next, Whakapapa on Ancestral Landscapes in Tautoro Te Taitokerau. It's a very narrow title. At the end, at least, I put the home community, the name of the community, because that's where I'm conducting the research, that's where it's from, where I'm from. But so Inayane is Māori for now. So I'm here now, and Imua is then. So I'm looking, using the present lens to look back at where we were as a community, and then looking forward, where can we go? And I say ancestral landscapes, and when I say ancestral landscapes, I mean the physical landscape, and included in that is water. It's one entity. Ancestral landscape is, it includes the water, it's land and water. And that broad statement allows me to talk about a whole lot of things. I look firstly at pre-colonization history, on the activities that were conducted on the landscape prior to colonization, pre-1776. What were our people up to back then? What was going on the landscape? How are they utilizing their resources? How are they interacting?
What have you found out? I'm really interested to hear some specifics on this. Because we chatted off mic about your methodology a little bit, where you're basically just having informal kōrero with people in your community, often over quite sort of big, long, extended chats. And it might be useful to touch on the concept of the sort of the Māori way of looking at guardianship of natural resources and how that's a bit different from the sort of Pākehā philosophy of owning stuff.
It goes back to the beginning, and this is probably the start of my chapter. It's looking at the underlying Māori philosophy of interconnectedness, and it stems from the Māori worldview of creation at some point in the very distant past. There was nothing. It's called te kore. Te kore means the nothingness, and from that darkness, that nothing, came light, te ao marama. And so that te ao light came into the universe through what Māori call the sneeze of life, tihe moriora.
Gosh, so, is that what that means?
Tihe moriora.
Can we translate it as that, the sneeze?
The sneeze, yeah. Huh. So when someone sneezes, a Māori person will say to the person who's just sneezed, "Tihe moriora." It's the sneeze of life.
Cool.
So there's this belief that the world was came into being, the universe came into being from nothing, sneeze into. It's kind of Big Bang.
Like, boom.
It is, and so from nothing, there was this period of time where. Stuff began to happen. Energy was created from this sneeze, and within this space, rangi, it wasn't called rangi at the time, but rangi and papatūānuku, there was this formation of land and sky. There was darkness, and then through active, I guess the word is copulation. I guess there was a production of smaller entities or beings, and rangi being the male element and papa being the female element, they produced children in this dark void, and they became weary. They wanted to be in the light. They wanted to feel warmth. And so one of the offspring of rangi and papa, Tane. You never heard of Tane Mahuta?
Yeah.
In the forest up north, he's this embodiment of the, because he's such a big, strong, tall tree, he forced the heavens and the earth apart, and then light came into the world, and these offspring of rangi and papa populated the world essentially and created the lands and the oceans. All that. It's a very complicated story. I'm not doing justice to it, but because there are books written on this, and I'm not, as I said before, I'm not doing justice to it, but in a nutshell, we are, as humans, offspring of that union.
Part of it,
that creation story. So we all come from this entity of Papa Tūnuku. We live on Papa, the Earth Mother, and we derive sustenance from her, from the soils and from the water, the wai. The wai is seen as a product of the tears of rangi. So the sky, the water falling from the sky is considered the tears of rangi because of the separation. And so they're all one thing. They all come from the same beginning.
Right.
Oh, like water's the kind of the linking
element the link between the sky.
Almost the everything earth. Else you could say, oh, that one belongs to this, that one belongs to that.
You see the sky connected to the earth, and then water binds the two, and you as a human, you imbibe the water, they're all connected. The linking element is water. And in the water there is something we call Modi. Have you heard of it? I mentioned it earlier in Tihei Modi Ora. Modi is, what is Modi? Modi is the life essence. It's the word to describe essence, the Modi of something, the energy of something. In a nutshell, it could be something akin to the force, maybe. The force
in Star Wars.
In Star Wars. It's probably, when I say Modi, some people are like, oh, you mean the force? Like, yeah, dude, that's essentially what it is. Well, George Lucas.
But it's all stuff, right? Not just trees and animals.
Everything has a Modi.
Rocks.
Everything has a Modi. Naturally occurring things.
What about a house?
It has its own Modi as well, because you instill an energy in it. You can feel it when in a house, you go to a house and you feel something's not right, or you enter a door and there's a funny feeling you get, that maybe the Modi's off. When you go into a cemetery, for example, you can feel it's a different type of energy. There's different energies and different things. But taking it back to Star Wars and the Force, don't quote me on this, but I believe George Lucas borrowed that idea from the Chinese concept of qi.
True.
Which is very similar thinking to Modi, that everything is an energy or a life force, and that it is a balance of that energy. And I'm not quite sure, but maybe I don't know if anyone's written on this, but there's a possibility that because Maori or their ancestors, the Polynesian ancestors, from their migratory patterns from, say, Southeast Asia or China, took that thinking of qi or innate in all things and brought it with them on their journey throughout the Pacific, because Modi is also a thing in Eastern Polynesia, Hawaii, and many of the other islands, and it came to New Zealand, this thinking that there is a Modi in everything, an energy, and something to be respected, to be cared for, Modi is something that can be depleted, but never destroyed.
Right.
Can't destroy.
So it's sort of eternal, but you can kind of lessen the sort of goodness of it, the positive strength of it.
Yeah. What I'm looking at in my PhD thesis is, and it comes back to water, is I've been asking our kaumātua, our kuia, through kōrero sessions. Kōrero is talk, dialogue. It's very human. It's have a cup of tea, have a kai, before, after, during, and just talk. And so we have kōrero. I ask questions. They never really get answered directly. Those go around and around and around. But in it, you'll get gems, and you'll hear something about this particular point in the landscape or this particular historical act involving ancestors. And you're like, well, how's that relevant to what I'm trying to achieve? But you listen to it, you take it, and then you review it later, and then like, oh yeah, okay, now I see. I see how that's relevant in relation to a whole lot of other things. And so in kōrero with my kaumātua and kuia, kaumātua is elderly aged male and kuia is female, elderly female, who have lived lives and have got experience, but they may not have the academic degree, for example. It's talking, going back to what you were talking about last night, they don't have that education, formal education, but wise.
Mm.
Live long lives on the landscape, live long lives gardening, walking and talking, and just for the most part being one with the land. And so accessing the stories that they have of the landscape that were passed on to them from their kaumātakuia. And so when I talk to them, I'm actually accessing stories and knowledge from several generations that may not have been written but have been kept in the memory, but their memory banks. And part of my research is, well, an offshoot of the research is to try and capture those stories before they disappear, because they are the last generation, the 70 to 80 year olds. They are the last generation that really lived with the land, really lived on the land. I remember when I was a child, before I left home at 17, even my teenage years, the land around us was surrounded by gardens, gardens upon gardens, acres and acres of gardens full of potatoes, riwai, piru piru, kumara, taro, corn. They were living locally, living off the land. And I remember being a child going out and being amongst my community elders, kneeling down and picking the potatoes out of the ground, out of the soil. And where was I going with that?
Well, it's been interrupted.
Because it's sort of what we were talking about last night over the fire over a couple of beers, was that disconnection that we've experienced now between people and the land has, you know, Ra and I are kind of on the same page, and Waveney, I suspect you are as well, we reckon is probably to blame for a lot of sort of social ills.
There's a lot on that page.
Kind of weird, unexpected offshoots that being disconnected from your food and your land, which I think, like, it seems to me that in Māoridom there's a implicit importance in that. Like, it's very known how important that is, the connection with the land. And I think for, you know, being a European person who's in New Zealand, it's like it's less recognized, that importance. And maybe it is because this is a recent land, you know, of my family generationally, so that connection isn't there. But it feels like with most First Peoples around the world, that is so part of the culture. It's like you have to look after the land. The land has to look after you.
Land's everything.
Yeah. And we've interrupted that flow. So even within your, like, it's crazy that within your lifetime, as a dude in his early 30s, you've kind of been able to see this change
I've seen
your community.
It's not as though they weren't farming the land
in a commercial sense.
They were doing that because that was something that needed to happen. It was part of, well, at least in my home community.
And the gardening and why people aren't gardening anymore. I'm fascinated to know that. Like, I understand that there's lots of complicated things that have been going on in the last 20 years, but in your community, in a really tangible, finite sense, and the people that you know, why do you think people have stopped gardening?
People are still gardening now.
The older generation. Yeah, but the younger generation coming through, why?
There is a big effort within my community to try and get the younger rangatahi, the youth, involved in learning how to produce food, connecting with the soil in a physical and spiritual way, knowing that, that means knowing the history. To give value, to understand the value of today, you've got to look at how it was valued and looked after in the past. And so when kaumātakuia are saying stories about the landscape, this happened here at this particular site, this spring of water, this person did this here in the past, and the name of this spring is Te Māta, because Te Māta means the reflection. You could see yourself in the water,
or maybe you used to be able to.
Well, that's the beauty of it. If you can't see your reflection in the water because there's no water there, something's gone wrong.
Right. And through that oral, the storytelling, the transfer of the history and the information.
And putting it into the young ones who at a young age, I really interested, for the most part, I really interested in stories and tales and great deeds of past ancestors. Obviously, Kaumata and Gwia, our elders, have a lot to compete with because there's so many distractions within society today. There's the phones. Luckily, where we are, there's no cell phone reception. Going back to, say, the 1950s, when the mass urbanization, mass migration of Māori to cities, which left a lot of the home communities, their Tūranga Wāiwi, vacant, or the lands were... The concept in Māori is ahi ka. So ahi is obviously fire. Ka is to light, is the spark, is to glow. So the concept of ahi ka is to keep the home fires burning. Mm. It symbolizes the campfires that were outside and outside in front of the settlements, which signaled to others that the land was being utilized, the land was being looked after, or the resources were being utilized by the people of that settlement. So when in the 1950s, when mass urbanization became a thing through whatever reasons, what was going on in the 1950s, of a big post-World War II requirement of jobs, the job creations going on in the cities, Māori were moving towards those areas, and a lot of them grew up away from their home communities and left this vacuum of no people to attend to the ahi ka to keep the fires stoked. And that's an issue that a lot of Māori rural communities are facing today. It's happening within our community. There's not many young people living there now. There are a few, but there's not enough. There could be more. But in recent years, we've seen more people moving back because they can't afford to live in Auckland.
It's right.
Like migration away from the city centres.
Could you explicitly, just because I don't know if we've sort of mentioned it or defined it really, but when you talk about the difference between the sort of modern Western way of looking at the world, and particularly with regard to resources, versus the difference of the Māori perspective, like what is the Māori perspective?
Land, water, they're the same entity. They're not separated. And so they should be, they'd be cared for, just like you would care for your mother. If Papa Tuanuku, i.e. Earth Mother, which this type of thinking has similarities with other indigenous and non-indigenous cultures in the world. Look, Gaia is an example, which I think that comes from Greece. Pachamama in South America. This thinking that the Earth, the Whenua, the Papa Tuanuku is our mother, and we should care for her as she is caring for us. It is a give and take relationship, which is embodied in the concept of kaitiakitanga. To be a kaitiaki is to be a steward of the land. So it's being a steward, you have stewardship responsibilities. There is a responsibility to look after the land in which you live in, which is your immediate, the term I use is marae catchment. So in every Māori community, there will be a marae or several marae, and those marae relate to a specific whānau, family grouping, and a hapū, a wider family grouping. So several families who are genealogically whakapapa connected. So they have the responsibilities within their local rohe. Their rohe is a territory, to ensure that they are doing the best for Papa Tuanuku, for the earth. And that means, they've spent so much time with the land, they understand the fluctuations, the changes, because you're in amongst it. You're living it, you're touching it, you're working with it, you're eating from it. So you've got this, you have a relationship, a physical and a tangible.
Probably quite a heightened sense when things are changing and what that means. And if something tastes like this, there's too much of this in the soil or something like that.
The test is the Māori of it. And the best way to do it is looking at the state of a spring or a river. And you can tell when a river is sad, or the Māori has been depleted to say, I don't know, on a scale of 1 to 10, a 1, or it's a code red, for example. and you'll what Māori would look for in trying to gauge the Māori of a river would be the sight, the physical appearance of it, the smell. What are the local fish in the river? What are they doing? Are they present? What is this little ecosystem? How is it? What is its state? So they have Māori is the tester, the means to test it.
And with each of these marae catchments, as you were saying, like it's their responsibility to ensure that Māori is kept sort of pristine or kept strong.
Yes.
In their patch.
And they do that in their own little ways, but it's been made hard by the changes on the landscape, the change of the ownership of land, the compartmentalizing of land blocks, the delineation of land, the segmenting of land, so people start owning little bits and pieces here and here and here. And you just look at a map and see how segmented everything becomes on this map. Just like with the Tauturu, for example, it was all one landscape. There were boundaries between groups that lived on the landscape, but those boundaries were fluid.
Right.
And within those boundaries, there would be relationships, communication as to, okay, there's your boundary. If you cross that boundary, just come and talk to us first.
Right.
It's about dialogue. Kōrero, sitting down. Obviously, the kōrero sometimes broke down and battles occurred. Fighting over resources. Yes, that happened.
But it wasn't in the same way how we think about it now, where it's like this this exact line here
on this
is
map,
mine, and this is yours.
Yes.
Plus, I guess there was some shared values there anyway. Like different hapu probably were looking after the water in a similar way to each other.
Yeah, they probably had a shared, like a sort of singular goal of ensuring that your environment was being looked after.
And that goal of ensurement was for future generations, ngāuri whakatupu, the future generations. It's always thinking intergenerationally, looking forward and thinking, well, what am I doing today? And how are my actions today going to influence the situation for my offspring?
Mm. This episode is brought to you by Ecotricity, New Zealand's only power company that's 100% renewable and carbon zero certified. It's Ecotricity's mission to provide Kiwi homes and businesses with 100% pure renewable power. By choosing Ecotricity, you're supporting the development of new renewable energy and proving New Zealand's economy can grow without costing the earth. Find out more and sign up at ecotricity.co.nz. So looking forward, have you, through your research or through your kōrero, discovered some wins, anything that is working for you guys or you feel has potential, anything that's even kind of universally applicable that could work for other communities?
That's a good question. If you want to boil it down, it's about forming relationships, people-to-people links, crossing that cross-cultural divide through breaking down that line, those delineations on the map, and realizing that we're all kind of connected. We're all
Made up. Those lines
we're all on the
real.
Same landscape, and it's all one entity. And so, you've got this regional councils. They have under law, they have responsibilities to care for the environment and care for their territory. In our community, especially for a lot of people, councils are irrelevant. Council is some entity in Whangarei or some entity in Wellington that has no understanding of what's going on in Tauturu. So a lot of our people are they've actually always had this thinking of caring for their own patch. Irrespective of what rules and regulations the government's passed, and it's inherent in the thinking of mana, irunga I te whenua, the authority over the local resources, over the land. And that authority comes from being a steward. Right now, it's about trying to educate our pākehā colleagues who are in roles of responsibility in council to say, hey, this is how we see things here. This is how we've been doing it for X amount of years. We would like to have kōrero with you and try and find a way forward. What can we learn from each other? it comes back to dialogue and having a relationship. There's such a big disconnect between sort of local, rural communities, Māori communities, and council. It's trying to bridge that gap, and that takes people who understand what's going on in the community and have the ability to speak the language of both sides. It's all about finding commonality. Okay, most people care about the environment, their immediate environment. We probably agree on that, I think.
Yeah.
We care about our families. We care about our future families, however small or big they may be. Māori have a bigger family because we're all related. And so there's probably a difference there in terms of the magnitude of care.
Mm.
But so it comes back to educating our colleagues, our people in say local government, saying this is how we feel about the landscape, this is what we value. Have you thought about this? I can give you an example. A lot of council interactions, especially when resource consent applications go through, for example, and an issue arises where there needs to be some hapu engagement or whānau engagement or iwi engagement on an issue, say water take, for example, or resource consent to take water. If it goes to not a litigious stage, a litigation stage, but a meeting has to occur between the parties, it always is held in council chambers. Mm. It's away from the land in which you're actually talking about. And I can give you an example. It goes back to how expensive it is to live in Auckland. There's mass migration going north and south. Northland's recently become the avocado capital of New Zealand. Great growing conditions, excellent soil. Water, not at the right time. It's very, very, it's prone to fluctuations in seasonal availability of water. But there is a lot of water up there. And the right climate to grow things like avocados. And avocados have all of a sudden become a trending food, I guess a health food. A lot of farmers are now selling their lands to horticulture farmers who are now planting avocados and kiwi fruit. And places like Tauturo have availability of land, of good soil, of relatively cheap land. And that's such a bad word to use, cheap, but inexpensive land from the perspective of a buyer. And some of these lands would have been historically hapu lands, hapu landscapes, hapu tribal estates through the crown title purchasing process have been sold, or it's a very, very complex issue. But to break it down, a lot of landscapes, particularly in the 1920s onwards, would have required mortgages to develop their lands. Some land blocks within our community were the local Māori were unable to service their mortgages, so the banks, well, not even the banks, the government who were in charge of the funds would foreclose on those mortgages.
Oh, wow, I didn't know that.
Whānau would lose their lands.
So the government was acting as the bank and then on people.
Foreclosing on whānau members who were trying to pay the mortgage, but some lands were hard to work, or they were just not yet skilled enough to be good farmers.
In
this new system of dairy, of milking cows and producing butter. And
all the finance systems.
This whole money thing.
Yeah.
Still trying to get their head around it.
Man, that's, you know, people wouldn't have had any idea, I imagine, when they took out a mortgage that it could have been their ancestral lands that were on the table.
Some were, obviously. I'm not saying that certain whānau were not complicit in the sale of their lands. The sale of lands did occur for various personal reasons, and a lot of land was sold that way. But there are instances that I know of in our community, and I'm certain that it's happened elsewhere in the country, where those landscapes were lost and are now moved into non-Māori ownership and are now coming up for sale. And by right, under our current legal system, that is fine. Once you've got that titled land, that piece of paper that says you own this little section of land on the map, that's yours to do what you want with it.
Mm-hmm.
And for the most part, it's conceptually...
It's a difficult thing to reconcile. Process.
We've obviously... climatized, become accustomed to it. My family has lands that are a part of that system. That's just how land is seen and changed hands. But within our community, one large section of land was purchased in 2016 by a company, and I won't say any names, but to turn it into, from a dairy farm into an avocado orchard, and invested a significant amount of money into it. And involvement of the local community in this plan, this purchase of the land, it did occur. It was minimal, in a sense that the company came in and were like, well, we're legally advised. It's good practice to talk to the locals to say, hey, this is what we want to do. We bought this land. This is our intention. We're going to need X amount of water for X amount of years to get this crop. We'll, and this is the clincher, we'll give you jobs, and we'll give a scholarship to any young community members who want to learn about horticulture. And those are good things. It's not to say that they're not good things. They are.
Jobs is such a generic thing to say, because there's other models where you could get more jobs. So just because you might create some jobs doesn't mean that it's
that they're good.
That it's the best scenario that we could have had. But anyway,
And you're right. And one of the aspects of my PhD is to look at the definition of consultation, because under the current laws, under the RMA, it's considered best practice to consult with local stakeholders, which in most cases, it's not always Māori, but in this case it is Māori because it's a rural Māori community. But what constitutes consultation?
Great question.
And best practice also doesn't seem like legally binding, is it? It's like this is the ideal model.
Yes.
This is the gold standard of doing it.
No one likes
it. It's not to the letter of the law.
I can imagine companies don't like doing it. And I've heard through owners of companies who are involved in this, they don't like doing it because it costs money. It costs time, energy, money. And they have shareholders to consider. And it all comes back to money.
Just specifically on that, was the community cognizant of the fact that, because I know avocado trees are super thirsty, and did they know that this was going to put a real restraint on the water supply that was there to use all of that for an avocado orchard?
This is the thing. At these local meetings between the company and the community, and I acknowledge the fact that they came to the marae. They actively sought out local community members. They got in touch with the council. They got in touch with the local iwi, saying, hey, this is our project, and I commend them for that. That's the right thing to do. That is, we're getting there. Mm. We're getting closer to this thing of a partnership or co-governor or co-management or this thinking of you and I. We're not there yet, as my research is showing, but we are on the path. So this consultation occurred on our marae. It wasn't well attended. There weren't maybe 17 people there from a community that may have 300 people living in it, but the whakapapa connections to this community number in the thousands. They don't live in the community, but their hearts are still there. That is their Turanga Waiwai. And so they weren't present at this meeting. And so when this meeting occurred, the proposals were voiced, slideshows, scientific data, all the stuff that no one really understood was put out there. And it was essentially, hey, this is what we're doing. And I think there was no opportunity to reply in any, it's almost as if the decision was already made. Hey guys, this is what we're doing. We bought this land, this is what we're doing, and thank you for your time.
Yeah, right.
We'll hear your stories about your attachment to land and stuff like that, but it's almost like a tick of the box, and it is a tick of the box exercise. And it's not until later, 2 years later, where everyone's feeling, oh, hang on, how much, what do you need? 2.5 million litres a day for 35 years. Is that a lot of water?
Is that cool?
When you think about it, well, 2.5 million litres, what's that, an Olympic sized swimming pool per day for 35 years? Obviously, that's not what they would be taking every day, because the natural seasonal influence of rain, they don't need to take water, they need to pump water from the ground.
But that's what the consent received was for.
They haven't received it. It's still in the process, because we as a community have come together and said, hey, actually, is this the type of activity we want to happen in our community? Okay, we understand that we cannot stop people doing what they want to do with their land. We're not about that. We're not naive to the fact that law, a land title system, allows people to do what they want with the land to a degree.
But yeah, with water, there are some constraints around that, aren't there? You need a permit to take.
Yes, and there will be flow management systems put in place. But what we... It goes back to how the community conceives the landscape or sees their landscape. And for us, we view ourselves as living downstream from our water source. We literally do live downstream from the river, but from a traditional local perspective, there is this large volcano in our community. It's called Totoro. It's actually the name of the community. It's called Totoro. And there's this large volcanic lake at the top. It's very technical how that landscape was formed, and I won't go into that right now because I'm not a geologist. But I should show you a photo. But anyway, it's a...
it'll be lost on the listener.
Yeah. It's a beautiful lake at the top of this flat-coned scoria hill. And in this lake, there's an island, a little island. The lake's called Kerridu. It was called Kerridu because of, in the past, the prevalence of Kerridu bird there, and that was the spot to go for Kerridu. And the significance of this water source, because it was so high, it's so elevated. It's a 10 hectare lake. I think it's the third largest open water source in the Kaikoura Ecological District. So within the center of the North Island, Northland, in the Kaikoura District, there's this lake there. I think the largest is Lake Omapere. I don't know if you guys have Lake Omapere. It's the largest lake in Northland. And then there's Lake Ōwhareiti, and then there's Lake Kerridu. And so this lake is highly elevated in the landscape. And because of its high elevation, clouds swirl around the top of Totoro, and rain is produced there, and precipitation happens, and it falls into the lake. And within the lake, there is this, as I said, an island in the middle, but in it is an ana. An ana is a cave. It's a cave system. And because of the volcanic activity, there was obviously pockets of air and gas that created this vent down into the crater of the volcano. And like an inverted mausoleum, I guess. The Maori traditionally would sail there, the dead chiefs, and inter them in this ana. But the fact that the lake was so high and there's this ana, the water would kind of seep its way through this subterranean passage of a cave system, essentially. That would, the water would fall through out into the landscape, would proliferate throughout the landscape, and it would appear in the local springs, which were below the lake. And so because the lake is so high, we believe that we live downstream from our water source. And it just happens that this land block that's been purchased is between the community and the lake source. The act of drilling into the ground to access the aquifer, which we see as the heart of our community. The underneath the heart is like the heart of Papatūānuku, essentially. Water falls from the sky. It falls into the lake. It then swirls its way down like a vortex throughout the landscape, and then comes out, debouches from the whenua, from the landscape, to then be engaged with physically for nutritional and spiritual benefit by drinking the water. So the act of drilling down into the ground and extracting water out from the land, from the aquifer, is almost like seen as an interruption of the flow of water, the flow of Māori from our water source.
Because when you say that you guys are living downstream of the water, that is literally true, but I imagine it sort of speaks to a bigger idea of, of the, how you think about that water, that it's sort of, you know, you are sort of below it.
Yes.
You know, you need to respect this thing. Mm. And then there's been this operation that's put itself in between the people and the water, effectively.
And it's not to say that their activities will deplete the Māori, because obviously they're aware that, oh, hey, we're going to do this activity, we need X amount of water for this amount of years. But it's just getting that thinking into their minds, like, hey, there's this people here who believe this way, who think of their environment in this particular way, who value it in this way. How can we fit in with this thinking? And I don't think that's what's occurring. It's like, we've got the right to do this, we've paid the money to do this, we've got the law that allows us to do this, and we've got the science to say that, and this is the clincher, science in a Western sense suggests that there is no connection between this lake and the natural springs that are around it in our landscape. We've got three important springs in the community, and one of them just sits below, not far from where this avocado orchard is situated, and where the community is adamant that there is a connection. Mm. In a holistic sense, there's a connection. Everything is connected. But there's also a potentially a physical connection. We can't prove it, but we believe it.
Mm.
And this cultural belief influences the value of the water and the landscape. So it's just trying to get this way of seeing things into the minds of people who are conducting those types of activities, and potentially getting councils on side to start thinking along these lines as well.
Yeah.
It's almost like,
Don't carry on.
How it's each person's responsibility to be on a journey to connect. There's a real opportunity here for people. We've on the one hand, we've got, you know, this huge percentage of New Zealanders that are now saying we care about sustainability and we want to see things done differently and we don't want this future for our children. It will be those same people that you would be dealing with. And so there's that opportunity for all of these people that are on the one hand able to say with one part of the brain, look, we really care about this issue, but on the other hand, haven't made some connections. And I think that's the journey. And that's part of what I think we're really keen to communicate, eh, Tim, is that if we just look at one thing and you drill it right down to the basic, like say this company saying, we want water, we've done some studies, everything looks like it's okay. Mm. And so they've drilled it right down to sort of one little narrow problem with one little, they've compartmentalized it. And because that's really cultural, and there's huge, like you were saying, momentum of history behind that way of thinking. And that's the challenge for our generation, to work out how we can put the brakes on that thinking and connect. Because it's the same people and it's the same hearts and minds that have already said, yes, we want to do something about this and yes, we care, but just haven't yet, or perhaps are in the process of making those connections.
And it's also interesting that as the science advances, like we did an episode with Dr. Mike Joy, who's one of the foremost experts on water ecology.
Was he on the show?
Health. Yeah. Wow. Did an episode with him.
Cool.
And it seems like the science is catching up with these ideas, which a lot of cultures have known for ages intrinsically, because they've had to coexist with the environment and have been sort of at the behest of the environment. Like, if you don't respect it, you get wiped out. And now the science is kind of going, it turns out there is effectively a life force in the water, because there's all these like
the things
incredibly connected microorganisms and all of these biospheres sort of within the water that interconnect. And if you overfish or you do something that's going to disrupt the algae or create a bloom or something, it kills everything.
Yeah.
Which is sort of just another way of looking at the things that you're talking about, I feel, like with Māori. It's like that science is sort of catching up to put a different frame on what a lot of people have known, like your people have known for ages. Yeah, would you agree with that?
I'd agree with that.
Yeah. We might need to wrap up because we've got another episode that we need to tape. But if I'll give you an opportunity to, if you feel like there's anything important that you want to add, Ra, while you're here, but while you have a think, I'd just like to thank you for coming on and sharing all of this information, particularly because I know that you've you're working so hard at the moment to gather this information on behalf of the people in your area, and I know that the sharing of information as well is a very sacred thing, so I appreciate that you've like trusted us to come on and share these things, because as you've been speaking about, you know, in multiple different junctures, I think that that kōrero and us to be able to come together and figure out where the commonalities are, like that's going to be the thing that gets us out of the shit with a lot of these issues that we talk about on this podcast, with the environmental damage that's happened. I think if we can just start really like actually listening to each other, and recently the resurgence of te reo Māori and the re-importance of the culture coming back alongside that, the concept of, is it kaitiaki, is that the concept of like custodianship over
stewardship would be stewardship,
right,
an apt way of putting it. When you think of being a steward, you're a caretaker, and it's less about control and authority, it's more about defining the relationship with people and your natural environment, and not in the context of winners and losers. If the environment loses, we lose.
Yeah.
So hey, let's all win together. Yeah, so tēnā koe, well, thank you for having me on. I'm sorry there was a few blank spaces there.
Not at all. We've had a big night. Thank you for joining us again for this episode. And share it with your friends, please. Thank you to all the people who have left reviews for us.
Yeah.
On iTunes. I appreciate that. And you should join us on Facebook as well. Facebook.com/How to Save the World.
Because we're so prolific on Facebook, aren't we, Tim?
We're getting better.
Yeah.
In all aspects of life, we're improving. We are flawed people trying to do our best.
That's great.
But we will catch you in the next episode. And until then, ka kite anō. Thanks again to our sponsor, Ecotricity, New Zealand's only provider of 100% renewable and carbon zero certified electricity. Find out how to switch your home or business at ecotricity.co.nz.